Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 29th of August. National Geographic's cover story for September is Rising Seas, How They Are Changing Our Coastlines. And the author of the piece is our guest this hour, Tim Folger. Tim has been writing about science and the environment for more than 20 years on subjects ranging from quantum mechanics to tsunamis. He recently won the American Institute of Physics Science Writing Award and has been recipient of Best American Science Writing on many occasions. 136 coastal cities are now at risk from sea level rise, 40 million people at risk in those cities, $3 trillion value of assets are at risk. As the planet warms, he writes, the sea rises, coastlines flood. What will we protect? What will we abandon? And how will we face the danger of rising seas? We'll be welcoming your phone calls for our guest, and here is how you reach us. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Tim Folger, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks very much for having me.
What a difficult article this was to read, and it must have been even more difficult to put together. Let's start with the worst scenario here. You do say that even if we stop burning all fossil fuels tomorrow, the existing greenhouse gases would continue to warm the Earth for centuries. So we have irreversibly committed future generations to a hotter world and rising seas. That's very disturbing.
Yes, that's the great tragedy of all this. You know, just a decade or two ago, I think many of us had hoped that we would be able to limit CO2 emissions and prevent some of the worst effects of climate change. But it's looking increasingly unlikely that we've missed that opportunity. We still have to do all we can, of course, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But we're rapidly moving into an era where we'll really have to start planning for adapting, mitigating, and just trying to cope with the disasters our failure to act has put into motion.
We still remember Hurricane Sandy pretty vividly, and some of the article deals with how people in New York were dealing with this, and also warns us that we may see more storms like Sandy because that will happen as a result of the world getting warmer.
That's right. There are a few different issues. There's the issue of extreme weather events, which many scientists believe we're already seeing some of those. And then there's the issue of sea level rise itself, which is this steady, creeping, slow-motion disaster that will make any storm worse, whether it's a Sandy scale storm or a smaller nor'easter. Storm surges of the sort that we saw with Sandy, which was a record storm surge in New York City of 14 feet, I believe it was. Many meteorologists were calling that a once-in-a-century storm or even a once-in-a-500-year storm. But by the end of this century, when sea levels might be 2 or 3 feet or perhaps even higher, storm surges and flooding like we saw with Sandy, instead of happening once a century, may happen once a decade or perhaps even more often.
You have spoken to scientists all over the world. Is there a consensus about how fast and how high the seas will rise?
There's an emerging consensus on the minimum amount of sea level rise we can expect, and that's going to be at least 2 feet. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is an international body of scientists that works under the auspices of the United Nations to periodically assess the state of the world's knowledge about climate change, released a report in 2007 that predicted a maximum amount of sea rise of 23 inches. The IPCC's latest report is due out later this year, but already that high-end figure might actually fall at the low end of predictions for sea level rise now by the end of the century. I spoke with some scientists who believe that 3 feet is likely, we could see as much as 6 feet by the end of the century, depending on how fast the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica melt and the glaciers. And we've been seeing an accelerated rate of melting of the Greenland ice sheet. For instance, Greenland's ice sheet lost mass about six times faster between 2002 and 2011 compared with the period between 1992 and 2001. So, you know, six times faster. And I think we can expect to see more of that, unfortunately, you know, tragically, for the rest of the century. It's I'd be surprised if the low end estimates that scientists are contemplating hold true. It's estimates have repeatedly proven to be too conservative in the past. And I think that's likely to be true now, and unfortunately.
You also write about this big wild card, a glacier in West Antarctica involving the physics of ice fracture that we really don't understand. What is that glacier, and what is the physics of ice fracture?
Yeah, the glacier in question is the Thwaites Glacier in West Antarctica. And if that glacier were to drop into the sea, it would raise global sea levels by, I think it's 9 meters. I'd have to double check, but by an amount that would be disastrous for the world. The scientists I spoke with about that said that they think it's unlikely that that will occur in the century, but they can't rule it out completely. And the great uncertainty lies, as you mentioned, in the physics of ice fracture, which is a very complex process. Physicists just, or you know, geophysicists, geologists, people who study ice, glaciers, just don't understand how something so large, what are the factors that determine how it disintegrates? It's not something that's happens in a predictable fashion. It's not something you can easily study in the laboratory when you have, you know, such a massive amount of ice. It's just an experiment in progress. And, we just have to hope that that glacier stays where it is. I just double-checked the amount of sea level rise. It would rise by 3 meters, nearly 10 feet, if that glacier broke free.
There are some cities in the world, and you spent some time in some of them, particularly Rotterdam, that have made some kind of preparations for global warming and have had to, because of past floods, establish dikes and establish systems for keeping the water out of communities. What can we learn that we may need to do in places like New York City, in other areas that have been experiencing these massive kinds of floods? What did you learn from Rotterdam?
I think the most important thing I learned from Rotterdam is that we have to treat climate change as a matter of national security and, you know, of course, global security, really. Now, that's how the Dutch see it. More than 25% of their country lies below sea level, and without their, you know, thousands of miles of dikes and the enormous storm surge barriers that they've erected over the past 60 years, the country would, most of it would be underwater now. Mm-hmm. So the United States, all countries that have, large port cities, really have to look at this as a matter of national security. It's, I think, in terms of all the many issues facing us as a nation, mass incarceration or surveillance by the NSA, voting rights, I think climate change trumps them all, because it really, I think, it poses an existential threat to our civilization, and it's really incumbent upon us as citizens to, elect people who are informed about these issues and committed to doing something about it. So I think it was that sense of national emergency that struck me the most in Rotterdam. And then, of course, the amazing preparedness of the Dutch. They're way ahead of everybody else in the world in dealing with this problem.
And you write that it was a response to a big storm in 1953. Contrast that with New York City and Hurricane Sandy, which caused a loss of life, enormous billions of dollars worth of damage to that area. Has that area made any of the improvements that the Dutch made after the 1953 storm?
New York hasn't yet. You know, New York is probably where the Dutch were back in 1953. That storm in 1953, it killed more than 1,800 people.
Oh my.
In the course of, two or three days of flooding. And that just transformed Dutch national policy and I think the Dutch national psyche. You know, they realized this was, a tremendous threat to their existence as a nation. They are much smaller than the United States, of course, so while sea level rise doesn't threaten the existence of the United States as a nation, it threatens the nation's greatest cities. Earlier this summer, Mayor Bloomberg announced some very ambitious and far-sighted plans, in response to the Sandy disaster, things that would include putting in some movable flood barriers that could be taken up or taken down after a flood. A series of far-sighted plans. It's not clear whether his successors will follow through on some of the policies he mentioned. And I think he was estimating the cost for the steps he's hoping to implement would amount to about $20 billion, which is about the damages that Sandy caused to the city. New York has a long way to go still. And even with Mayor Bloomberg's far-sighted plans, which are, way ahead of any other city, what any other city in the United States is contemplating, except perhaps New Orleans, Mayor Bloomberg didn't include any plans for a big storm surge barrier that would protect the entire harbor. Many other cities around the world have such barriers. There are a few in the Netherlands. Russia has one in St. Petersburg. New Orleans has them, of course, now. But New York will probably need one at some point. But that wasn't included in Mayor Bloomberg's plan.
And he's about to leave office, so who knows what his predecessor will do about it. The National Geographic always has these remarkable pictures, and there's one that stands out for me in your article, and that's dangerously exposed to the next typhoon, squatter families crowd waterfront shanties in Manila in the Philippines. This is just a dramatic picture. It's amazing anybody can live in these kinds of circumstances, and living right on the water. I would imagine there are a lot of poor people in coastal communities all over the world that are already facing a need to go somewhere else. I don't know where they would go.
That's the big issue right now. Earlier this summer, I was reading about the violence in Myanmar, where Muslim refugees from Bangladesh, it turned out, were the targets of violence by the majority Buddhist population in Myanmar. And I didn't follow through on this. It would be interesting to see how many of those Bangladeshi refugees in Myanmar were climate refugees, because Bangladesh is a low-lying country, of course, very poor, won't have the resources on its own to cope with sea level rise. That's an entire country that's threatened by sea level rise. The rest of this, later in the century, we'll see enormous shifts in population who will have no place to stay in their own country. Where will they go? How will the world accommodate them? And the United States itself might be seeing this in coastal Florida and on the Gulf Coast. Enormous shifts in population. It's going to be a tremendous problem, and we're just not we're just not thinking about it.
No, we're not. Yeah. Well, you say very dramatically, because it makes you think about this. We always think there's a Miami, Florida, and there will always be a Miami, Florida. And truth is, there may not be a Miami, Florida.
That it's astonishing to hear, isn't it? And, you know, just as a journalist, when I was the scientist who told me that was a geologist named Hal Wanless at the University of Miami in Florida. And, you know, I'm sitting in his office and he's telling me these things. Oh, yeah, by the end of the century, he said, I can't see many people living in southeastern Florida. You know, with 4 feet of sea level rise, Miami will be an island. The Florida Keys will be pretty much underwater. It's just hard to accept all of this. And I think scientists are starting to speak out about the magnitude of the problem, but I think they've been reluctant. I think because it just seems almost incredible what they're telling us. It seems hard to believe. You know, we've for the past 2,000 years, you know, sea levels haven't risen all that much. We've enjoyed a very stable climate for the most part, and now that's changing, and we don't, our civilization just doesn't have that experience. How does civilization cope with an unprecedented threat? And so far we're not coping.
Tim Folger is our guest this hour. He's a science writer, and he has the cover story of the National Geographic for the month of September, Rising Seas, How They Are Changing Our Coastlines. Our phone number, I'm sure many of you would like to join this conversation, disturbing as it is, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you want to leave an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Tim is a science writer. He traveled all over the world for this article, and he has for many articles, because he has spent 20 years as a person writing about science and the environment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tim Folger is our guest. We're talking about the cover story of National Geographic for the month of September, Rising Seas. And we welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. Lori in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Lori.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. I just joined, so I hope I didn't miss this piece, but there's been recent information about the Great Lakes being so low, and I'm just curious about if there's any relationship, or why would the Great Lakes be so low when the oceans are getting higher?
Thanks, Lori, for that question. You know, that's not something I've looked into, but I'm guessing the Great Lakes might be facing separate issues: water use for agriculture, drinking water, local. I'm not sure. Drought. You know, I'm not sure how. You know, it's a continental body of water, so it won't be affected by sea level rise. So I think there are different issues that will affect inland bodies of water.
Thanks, Lori, for the call. An email from Wayne in Krakow. As sea levels rise, the hydraulic pressure of seawater versus groundwater has to be influenced as well. I suspect the influence would be greatest in areas like Texas and Florida, where the vast majority of the bedrock is porous limestone. Has anyone begun analyzing what rising sea levels will do to our freshwater supplies?
Oh, that is fantastic. And question, Wayne. When I was in Florida, I learned that Florida, as you pointed out, rests on a bedrock of highly porous limestone. Seawater is already encroaching and contaminating aquifers in Florida that, something like 20% of Florida's population depend on. That's it might be an insoluble problem. Right now, Florida uses these structures called, they're basically dams that have a bunch of fresh water behind the dams, and the fresh water is kept a few feet above sea level, just because just to because salt water is denser than fresh water, you need more dense water to kind of push the keep the seawater from contaminating the groundwater, but that's becoming more and more difficult to do as sea levels rise. You're faced with this dilemma of, well, you need larger quantities of fresh water behind those dams to keep the salt water out, but in doing that, you're kind of flooding the state from behind. You're flooding the land with groundwater behind these dams to keep out the seawater that's coming from the coast. So, you know, at some point, that just becomes unworkable, and I don't know what Florida is going to do. And when I asked a scientist in Florida that when I was there earlier this year, no one really had any solutions for me.
Will in Appleton, hi.
Hey, I haven't heard anything about this since Al Gore's movie that I saw, but I was curious if you know anything about what is going on with the potential for an ice age being triggered by global warming and how far that might be out or what's up with that. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks
Will.
I don't think we're in any danger of an ice age being triggered by global warming. It's quite the opposite threat that we're facing with business as usual. Now, I spoke with one scientist who said that the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere could reach 1,000 parts per million by the end of the century if we don't make any efforts to stop greenhouse gas emissions. Right now, we've already passed a milestone. We're at 400 parts per million, a concentration that we haven't seen on Earth in 3 million years. The last time CO2 levels were this high, sea levels may have been as much as 65 feet higher. And if we continue with business as usual, and if we do hit that 1,000 parts per million mark, that's a level of CO2 in the atmosphere that we haven't seen in 50 million years when the planet was ice-free. So far from triggering a new ice age, we're going back to an ice-free planet. That would take a few thousand, maybe 3,000-5,000 years to get to that point. But, you know, a new ice age is the least of our worries.
And what made the CO2 levels so high those many millions of years ago, Tim?
I don't have a concise answer for that one. That's really a separate story. I wish I could give it. I don't really have a concise answer for that one, Kathleen. I'm sorry.
But there is consensus among scientists that what we have done to the air, our release of these emissions, has caused the problem recently.
Absolutely. One of the items that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, you know, is preparing to release a report later this year or early next, and parts of that report were leaked last week, and one of the leaked items said that the rate of increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is unprecedented for at least the last 20,000 years.
One of the scientists you quote in your article says, unless we change course dramatically in the coming years, our carbon emissions will create a world utterly different in its very geography from the one in which our species evolved, which, of course, makes you think of the question, what do we need to change dramatically to keep from reaching some of these, not that we're not going to have consequences, because we will, but some of these dire consequences that you point to. What do we have to do?
We really have to, as soon as possible, start reducing CO2 emissions. That means really not leaving as much coal, oil, and gas in the ground as we can. I mean, and we're kind of doing the exact opposite right now with, you know, there's been an acceleration of natural gas development in the United States and fracking, of course. The push for oil exploration shows no sign of slowing down. We're kind of on the exact opposite trajectory from where we should be. Instead of thinking of ways to leave these fossil fuels in the ground, we're doing all we can to exploit them. And somehow the world's countries have to come together and say, you know, whether it's a carbon tax or, you know, technologies that would capture carbon dioxide from smokestacks. Scientists are working on those sorts of things, but it's not clear how effective they would be. And in any case, the longer we delay, you know, as you pointed out earlier, we've already committed ourselves irreversibly to a certain amount of warming just because of the amount of CO2 we've already put into the atmosphere. Even if we stopped emitting greenhouse gases tomorrow, the world is going to continue to warm for centuries to come, and sea levels will continue to rise for centuries to come as well.
Well, and one of your scientists says that large numbers of people, if this continues, will have to abandon coastal areas in Florida. You just talked about that. And other parts of the world, not just there, Bahamas, Bangladesh, a major amount of Florida, we're all going to have people move from those areas, and we may have to move at the same time. This scientist said we're going to see civil unrest, war. You just wonder how or if civilization will function. What an incredibly dramatic thing to say.
It is. And, you know, it's, again, as a journalist, I'm sitting there listening to this, and I say, yeah, is he overstating the case? It's just...
Right.
But this particular scientist was a very, you know, conservative. I had lunch with he and his wife, and they were both Republicans, it turns out. I think the danger lies not in overstatement, but in understating the magnitude of the problem. And it's just something that hasn't sunk in. Our politicians, our leaders seldom talk about it. It's the most pressing issue we face, and it's just not getting... I'm so glad, you know, you're devoting your show to this issue today, because, you know, it just doesn't get the attention it needs. And it's the slow motion crisis, I guess. It's just not something that's immediately in our face. And I guess as a species, we're just not evolved to deal with those sorts of long term threats. And certainly as a species, we've never confronted something like this. Our species and our civilization evolved and developed in a time of stable climate, and that time is ending now.
We go to Tom in Lansing next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I wonder if you could discuss warming's effect on ocean currents. I understand that the Gulf Stream might be able to alter its course fairly rapidly over a number of short decades, and its effect on Europe's climate.
Yeah, that's a big topic that I haven't explored for this particular story, and I don't know enough about it to really say anything insightful. But I'm aware that there has been research about changes to the Gulf Stream and how that might affect climate in Europe, but I don't really enough to say anything that would be worthwhile. I'm sorry.
Robert in Middleton, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. The article that your guest wrote is certainly superb. One thing that I'm very concerned about with climate change that we don't hear a lot about, and that's natural gas. Everything in America now seems to be on natural gas. It's the great savior, even with ads on National Public Radio, I might add. But I have a friend who's a petroleum geologist, and he's privy to some things maybe some of us aren't, but he was at a meeting with the EPA people in Washington once, and they were talking about how much natural gas, which is methane, is lost at the wellhead. And methane is a much stronger greenhouse gas than CO2. I think it may be 17 to 23 times as strong, if I remember correctly. But they're thinking that they may lose something like a quarter or a third of this gas at the wellhead, that it comes up and they don't capture it, meaning it goes right up into the air. And we may be killing ourselves to save a few pennies on energy. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Robert.
That's exactly right. I don't know the exact figures of how much methane escapes from wellheads, but I have heard that. And you're right, and that goes back to the issue of, you know, we have to leave these things in the ground to whatever extent that we can. Just you know, pulling them out right now is just going to cause us, you know, enormous problems in the future and enormous problems that our grandchildren will see, and they'll wonder why did we fail to act?
Well, do you see any signs? You've spoken to people all over the world, and there are some countries that have done a little bit to protect themselves. But considering the gravity of the situation, do you have any sense that the world is ready to address this and to take the very steps that are needed to avoid what surely could be a catastrophe?
Yes. The hopeful signs that I did see were, cities like New York are taking steps not only to, protect against rising seas, but also to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. So in some sense, I think, at least in the United States, cities are ahead of the federal government. Globally, most of the world has signed the Kyoto Protocols for to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The United States hasn't ratified the Kyoto Protocols, and Canada withdrew from the Kyoto Protocols, but Europe and a large part of the world, large part of the developed world, has agreed to the Kyoto Protocols, and unfortunately, they haven't been very effective. Since 1990, we've pumped, since 2000, I'm just looking at a website right now as we speak, since 2000, we've already put more than nearly 500 billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere, and this is despite the Kyoto Protocol's efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So there's certainly awareness on the parts of, leaders of some countries in the European Union that, and they've been struggling to try to confront this problem, but we're really losing the race, and you can't even really say we've entered the race yet. You have to really enter the race to be losing it, but we're not even trying to enter the race yet, it's hard not to be discouraged.
Bob in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I want to enter something that Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma said. He said, "I am a global warming denier." Now, as an individual, he has every right to say that. And even as a senator, he has every right to say that. But unfortunately, he and other deniers like him are standing in the way of any progress that we might potentially make, for instance, ratifying treaties. It seems like we've got a block of individuals who, for whatever reason, have made up their mind that they are not going to allow this conversation on climate change to move forward.
Tim.
Yes, to me, that's it's so incredibly irresponsible. They will go down, and they will not be looked kindly upon in history. So it's our duty as citizens again to make sure that we elect people who are informed about these issues and who are committed to acting on them. It always strikes me, our entire civilization, we depend so much upon science and technology. We depend on, satellites for our weather forecasts, for our communications, for our computer technology, for travel. We depend on science for so much, and we trust science for so much, even if we don't always aren't aware of the source of the magic around us that makes these technologies possible. But here we have the best scientists, the best climate scientists in the world, the overwhelming majority of climate scientists. Every major scientific institution on the planet says climate change is real. It's being caused by humans, and yet people who deny the existence of the threat, they're not willing to believe science in this one case. would they be so distrustful of science in medicine? Would they forego, you know, a cancer treatment that is based on an intricate understanding of the body? Would they refuse? Would they say that? Would they refuse to use computers because, I don't know, they're picking and choosing of what aspects of science are worthy of belief and which aren't. It's ludicrous. And in the case of, I think the climate change deniers, it borders on the criminal.
But do you think that their voices are loud enough? There are enough of those people who think that way that they can stop progress?
It's a mystery. There are climate change deniers all over, even in countries like the Netherlands. I met a few, but they're basically recognized for what they are, as crackpots. And why they have so much influence, I don't really write about politics. I'm not as informed about politics, so I guess there's money for climate change deniers from this isn't something I've looked into a lot myself, but I can imagine that some petroleum industries are backing some of these. I can't really say for sure, but I don't know why they have so much influence. It's perplexing.
Tim Folger is our guest this hour. We're talking about his cover story, the story he wrote front of the National Geographic for the month of September, and it's titled Rising Seas, How They Are Changing Our Coastlines. Tim is a science writer, has been one for a long time, and he traveled to various parts of the world to see what the rising sea levels are already doing and spoke with many scientists who really gave a very alarming picture of what could happen unless we change course pretty dramatically and pretty soon. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For you to join this conversation about the planet getting warmer, we have a couple lines open. They've been busy, but if you'd like to reach us, you can at this very moment. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email, use that if you'd like, talk@wpr.org. Or you can also go to our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Carl in Fox Lake is our next caller. Hi, Carl.
Hi. Could your guest address the feedbacks that are now in operation? And by that I mean the methane released from the East Siberian Arctic shelf and also the tundra and also the dark ocean feedbacks where the increase causes more increase by feeding back on itself. The feedbacks cause the linear increases in temperature to become nonlinear, and that means much faster warming. Some people are saying we could have 6 degrees Celsius warming in 10 or 20 years, which would extinguish life on Earth. Is this a possibility? And could your guest please address those feedbacks, which make things go nonlinear and much faster?
Yes, it's true that those feedbacks exist, but I didn't hear any scientists talking about such steep increases in global temperature in the short term. But those feedbacks certainly exist, and they do accelerate global warming. Most dramatic one, I suppose, is with the disappearance of ice cover at the poles. You know, ice reflects sunlight back into space, and so it keeps the Earth relatively cool. But as the ice disappears, not only do we lose that reflective ability, but the underlying oceans, the water below the ice becomes exposed to the sunlight, and it absorbs and holds that heat. So not only is the light, sunlight not being reflected back into space, but it's being absorbed. So there's kind of a double whammy.
Thank you, Carl, for the call. Mary in Madison. Hi. Hello, Mary.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry. You know, as a person that drives to work, you know, about a half hour each way, I'm sitting here listening to the conversation and wondering, you know, besides using mass transit, which really isn't available when you live out in the country, you know, I remember hearing about, like, hydrogen technology, I think, and, you know, is anybody working on that? Is that something that's going to be, I don't know, utilized? And would that then produce a new problem if people were using that?
I don't know a lot about hydrogen technology. It's a way to store energy and to it would provide a fuel, an alternative fuel cars. But I think hydrogen fuel propelled cars are probably, you know, still quite a ways away in the future. I think the real issue is, how do we generate our power? You know, you might be using an electric vehicle now, but what if your electric vehicle is ultimately depends on being recharged by a power plant that's burning coal? So until our power sources are derived mostly are no longer derived from fossil fuels, we'll all be. As we are now, we're all complicit in this problem. Every time we drive a car, every time we flick a switch, you know, we're all burning. We're all relying on fossil fuels to do that.
Did you meet, in your many travels, did you meet any scientists, Tim, who got you excited about a possible solution? Who said, "Oh, this is going on in this part of the world, and it's wonderful."
You know, a few years ago, I met with an architect in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he pointed out that the built environment, homes and factories, office buildings, are responsible for an enormous amount of greenhouse gas emissions just because of the energy that's required to light them and, you know, the elevators and air conditioning. And if we could make those buildings more energy efficient, we could, you know, do an enormous amount to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. That was very hopeful to me. That seemed like something that's very doable, just improving the built environment. I also, several years ago, met with a scientist who was working on ways to use certain rocks that absorb carbon dioxide. That seemed promising and something that maybe could be done on a large scale. But these are all very, well, that a lot of these are just very, not enough has been done yet. Again, it's, we have to find the national will to implement these policies. And again, it comes back to us as citizens. Who are we electing? Are the people we're electing informed and committed to doing something about the problem?
Thanks, Mary, for your call. Mark in Beaver Dam.
Hi, Kathleen. I just want to point out, this is my opinion, that the climate change and change in ocean levels, et cetera, is just simply a symptom. And the symptom basically is related to the problem of population. During my professional career, the world's population went from 4 to 6 billion. Now it's close to 7 or over 7 billion. And about 5 or 6 years ago, I had the pleasure of talking to a member of the Union of Concerned Scientists, and I pointed this out. It was at an energy fair, in fact. And I asked why the scientific community was not raising this issue of population and population growth, and the fact that we're basically throwing off the photosynthetic respiratory oxidation levels. You know, they basically, that's what controls our atmosphere. And he said that they had discussed the issue of population as a group, but they felt it was too politically hot of a topic, and that politicians were the ones that were supposed to bring that up. I'd like to have your comment or or your feelings on the issue.
I think that's true. Yeah, population is certainly a big part of the problem. But perhaps even equally important is, it's where people are. Excuse me. I think my phone is beeping, which means it's low on power. I'm just going to switch phones very quickly. I'll be right back.
Okay. Yeah, we don't want to lose your voice, or we wouldn't be able to hear you, obviously. Tim Folger is our guest. National Geographic cover story is what we're talking about this hour. It's a very alarming article, but worth your attention because of its importance. It's about sea levels rising and the effects we're seeing of climate change and how things might be worse than we thought. Are you there?
I'm back, Kathleen.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Sorry for that.
It's all right.
But yes, the question was about population, and that's certainly a problem. The more of us there are, of course, the more resources we'll use, the more fossil fuels we'll burn.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, there's the problem of developed countries versus undeveloped countries. And per capita, of course, developed countries, the impact of a birth in a developed country is much larger on the world's resource use than a birth in the developing world. You know, an American, you know, all of us, we use far more resources than per capita than people in developed countries. So it's a complex issue. Population is a problem, but it's also the use of resources by the world's wealthiest countries that I think is, in some senses, overshadows the population issue.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mark, for the call. Let's go to Josie in Sheboygan. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I think your question before, why people believe this bunk about global warming, they don't want to admit that humans are causing this, number one, and they don't want to give up their luxuries and all that they want, you know. And also, I really don't see anything changing except for the worse. I hate to say that. I'm 68 years old, and I just by looking, I'm not a scientist, but I put two and two together. I see how people are. Most people that I bring up certain subjects like this, they don't even know what I'm talking about, and they don't want to hear it. It's just, oh, bad news. Oh, so negative. That's what I hear. And it's just incredible. I don't see anything changing when you have people like that in the government, like you were mentioning before.
Let's ask Tim. Do you see hope, Tim?
I do see hope in things like the fact that we're having this discussion today and you know, you hope, and that there's so many people calling in who are concerned. So that's very hopeful. And the fact that National Geographic would make this their cover story and that, you know, their magazine reaches, millions of people. I think the number 35 million is in my head. I think that might be their total worldwide circulation. So I think that's the first step. We have to be aware of the problem before we can address it. And you're right, though. Most people don't even think about it, but we have to think about it. And you know, maybe 60 years ago we didn't think you know, things would change in terms of race relations in the country. And of course, we still have a long way to go. But now we have. Barack Obama is our president. Would that have seemed possible back in the 1960s? I don't know.
Well, there's a lot to be done, that's for sure. And I don't know, your article leaves one thinking that a whole lot needs to be done to get people to do something about it, and the time is now. I mean, the time is now, right?
That's right. The time was actually at least 15 years ago. Mm. But yes, the time is more than ever. It certainly is now.
Thank
We've
you.
Lost a lot of time.
Thank you, Tim, so much for being with us and for writing the article.
Thank you very much, Kathleen, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Tim Folger, he's a science writer. His piece is the September issue cover story of National Geographic, Rising Seas, How They Are Changing Our Coastlines. And we thank him for being with us. He is a science writer. He's been writing about science and the environment for more than 20 years, subjects ranging from quantum mechanics to tsunamis. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program. Thank you for all of your calls. Nice to hear from you. We have news coming up momentarily, and then we will continue asking if we need a higher minimum wage in this country as we get close to Labor Day. What do you think? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.